All right, it's Thinking Out Loud from KBIA. John Bowles is our guest. He will be in town next week for the Spring 2018 Town and Gown Dinner Lecture with the Kinder Institute for Constitutional Democracy. That's happening a week from tonight, April the 10th. And you can find out more from the Kinder Institute at democracy.missouri.edu. John Bowles is a professor of history at Rice University in Houston, has written or co-authored several books. Most recently is a book, Jefferson, Architect of American Liberty, which is available from Basic Books. And John, thank you for taking the time to talk to us today.
Thanks. Look forward to it.
All right. You have written, as we said, quite a bit about Thomas Jefferson, edited other books about Jefferson. And it brought to mind, I recall, we had Peter Onuf on our show last year, and I asked him the same question I will ask you. Of all the major characters in our history, of all the people involved with the nation's founding, what is it about Jefferson that continues to draw our interest? We still have more research done, more studying about him, more books about him than virtually anyone else in our nation's history.
Well, I think, you know, Jefferson was the cliche is a Renaissance man. I mean, Jefferson was an architect and a scientist and a paleontologist and a linguist and, you know, so I think people find that exciting. I mean, what I call the capaciousness of his mind. He was interested in everything. He once said he had a carnivorous interest, curiosity. He wrote his daughter one time, "There's not a sprig of grass that springs that I find uninteresting." And so I think people identify with this kind of hunger for knowledge and this interest in everything, and this person who seemed to know and be able to do practically everything. Plus, Jefferson wrote so well. I mean, Jefferson, in some sense, has some of the most famous quotes in American history. So he's interesting, he's quotable, he's very articulate. And then, despite the fact that we think of this man who was so smart and wrote so much and so forth, he also was a very loving father, a very loving grandfather. He was a very soft-spoken, gentle person. So there's just a lot that makes him, I think, attractive. And he's so puzzling. I mean, I think my book begins with some sentence, something like, "Jefferson puzzles us." I mean, here's this man who is filled with contradictions, and there are aspects of him that aggravate us and disappoint us, and there are aspects of him that thrill us. And so I think we like the complexity of him.
Yeah. In reading the description of the lecture from Kinder Institute that I saw on the website, we're told that you will speak on Jefferson's evolving attitudes about government power, free expression, and protection of liberties, reflected in his view that the Constitution could and should change as the nation matured. Now, this idea, the idea of a living constitution, obviously is not universally held, but how did Jefferson view that idea of the Constitution evolving over time or the living document?
Well, there are many sort of themes to Jefferson's life. Like, one theme is what he once called the illimitable freedom of the human mind. But he also believes that the past should never sort of hold a lock on the present, that the people should sort of live in the moment. He very much believes that the Constitution, or a Constitution, is the fundamental foundational document of a people. But he believes that as people, as times go, as science improves, as we learn more, as we evolve, that our attitudes toward government, our needs, change. He once says it'd be about the same as saying that a man should wear the same jacket he wore as a child, to say that the same constitution that we wrote when we were a brand new nation should always governs us. So he does very much believe that the Constitution is limits what power can do, what the nation can do. But he believes that people have within their right to occasionally meet and to sort of reconsider these kind of things. And as science grows and knowledge grows, and we become a larger, more complicated, more complex nation, then we need to sort of periodically get together and kind of rethink our fundamental laws. So he very much believes that the Constitution is a living document. It's not a sacred document. I mean, he knew the people who wrote it. He says, "I was very much of that time, and these are great men." But again, this is not a sacred document. And that as we understand that the nation has more money or has new needs and so forth, we need to kind of periodically revisit that fundamental law and update it, change it, sort of make it fit our sort of modern needs.
Not just in talking about the Constitution, but I'm struck by the word evolved in describing Jefferson's own views on the topic. And I always like seeing that. That to me is the sign of a mind at work, the ability to learn, to say, I used to think this, but now I think this. What could you think of as some examples of Jefferson's thinking on one issue or another evolving as he learned more or just got more mature?
Well, I mean, almost any aspect of Jefferson, he wrote so much, you often know what he says and what he thinks. And Jefferson was constantly reading. He was constantly learning. He was having all different kinds of experiences. And so, as a thinking man, his views change. I mean, that actually makes it easy for people who want to sort of say that he's self-contradictory or inconsistent. You can find something he says in 1777 and then discover he says something different in 1715. But, I mean, you know, you show me a person who believes when he's 60 exactly what he believes when he's 15. I'll show you a person who doesn't think very much, doesn't grow very much. And so whether you're talking about Jefferson's attitude toward religion or toward cities or toward government or whatever, all these kind of things, as the nation grows, as Jefferson goes, as his range of experience increases, he changes his mind. He grows. He learns. And I see that not as an indication of inconsistency or flip-flopping, but as the indication of an intelligent human being who learns and grows through time.
You mentioned a term in following politics, and I certainly do follow up what's going on in politics very closely. That's a term that always bugs me a little bit because, I like I said, I see a mind at work when I recognize somebody saying, you know, I used to think this, but I thought about it more. I listened to other people, and obviously that's something that Jefferson's doing. John Bowles is our guest. He is going to be speaking next week on the Mizzou campus with the Kinder Institute, democracy.missouri.edu, if you'd like to find out more about his lecture. In talking about the man himself, your book, a very comprehensive telling of Jefferson's stories, and in recent writings, as you do research for your book, even after decades of historical study for yourself, you must have found new things about Jefferson's life. What do you remember learning as you put the book together that kind of surprised you about Jefferson to learn that maybe you didn't know before?
Well, I tell you, I began thinking about writing a biography of Jefferson in 1965. And I went to graduate school and I took a course in a great Jefferson scholar named Merrill Peterson. So I've been reading and thinking about Jefferson for more than 50 years, but I didn't actually get around to start writing a biography until 2013. But when 2013 came and I began to really intensively research it, I wasn't approaching the topic, you know, as a novice. I had been reading the Jefferson monographs and the biographies and so forth for 50 years, so I didn't expect to find something that I never imagined. What I did find out is I started with Jefferson's letters. There are now 53 volumes of them, and there are a lot of letters that are not yet finished, so you have to read those in the Library of Congress on the computer. But I just began by reading his first letter, and I just read systematically all, you know, thousands and thousands of letters. And I began to realize that I, and like many historians, when doing a topic, for example, if I had been writing just about the Lewis and Clark expedition, I would have gone to Jefferson's letters, and I'd used indexes and so forth, and I would have found the letters in which he talked about the Lewis and Clark expedition, and I could have put together a sort of a story of how that began. But then I began to realize when I read all his letters just in order in which he wrote them and in which his correspondence returned to him, I began to realize that in any week or any month of a president's life is not divided up into this is a Lewis and Clark month or a Lewis and Clark year. In a given week, he's writing and receiving dozens of letters on every conceivable topic. And I began to realize that, you know, what's happening in northwest when he reads about a guy named Mackenzie, a Scottish trapper who had gone across Canada to the Pacific Ocean in 1791, and he reads about it in 1802. Or then when he realizes that he discovers that Spain has given Louisiana to France. This is all happening at the same time. He's beginning to think about the Lewis and Clark expedition. So I began to realize the welter of forces that are at work in a president's mind any time he's making a decision. And you start seeing connections between what he's reading and what's happening in France and what's happening in Spain and what's happening in England and so forth. All those kind of things are in his mind as he's considering any one decision. And so I just began to see things in a deeper detail and with, I guess, richer meaning. Not that I discovered anything totally new, but I understood the kind of welter of forces that are working on a president's mind when he's making decisions.
So if nothing else, a different perspective on how all of this was happening. And what you describe, I mean, you say that, and we can imagine that being the president's life, and who better suited to having so many different important things to think about and talk about and write about at the same time than Jefferson, it sounds like. So
yes. So yeah, that is, rather than researching one thing at a time, I just read through everything chronologically, and you begin to see how all different sort of disparate events are interacting to shape his approach to any particular problem.
John Bowles with us, Rice University history professor, and again, he's speaking next week here on the Mizzou campus with the Kinder Institute. Our national views of Jefferson have certainly evolved over time, in fact, over just recent decades. And you mentioned this before, there certainly is the idea of some contradictions or hypocrisy from some of the greatest statements in our nation's history about human equality came from a man who held slaves. Have we spoken more, at least white people in this country, looking into that part of this more than maybe we did in the past?
Oh, yes. I mean, Jefferson's image has gone up and down, and he has been looked at favorably or disfavorably at different times in history. I mean, Merrill Peterson years ago wrote a great book called The Jefferson Image in the American Mind that talks about the kind of up and down of Jefferson's reputation. And Jefferson's reputation has taken a great fall, say, since the 1960s, mm-hmm. as we've become more aware of race and racism in our history. And that becomes a problem. How do you deal with the fact that this man, who wrote some of the most eloquent words in our history about liberty and freedom, and who wrote All Men Are Created Equal, how do you deal with the fact that he owned slavery? And this is an incredible paradox that we have to deal with. And you don't deal with it just by sort of simplicity saying he's a hypocrite, move on. You have to deal with, in the first place, every leading person in the South, George Washington, Madison, John Marshall, Monroe, they all owned slavery. And you have to realize that Jefferson is not a person living in 2017. He's really an 18th-century person. And then you're faced with this paradox, is that he spoke out against slavery and acted against slavery more than any of the other founding fathers. Mm-hmm. Yet he never found it. He never had the creativity or something to sort of actually free his slaves, or free the nation's slaves. Now, I think there are complicated reasons for why that's so. There were legal reasons. He was always in debt, and there were legal reasons that sort of tied his hand about ending slavery. But Jefferson, as president, has this amazing commitment to what I guess we call democracy. He believed that if you were a dictator, if you were a monarch, and you decided slavery was wrong, you could just sort of by fiat say slavery's ended. That's the way monarchs worked. But Jefferson was fundamentally opposed to monarchalism. He once wrote, George Washington, I was opposed to monarchism before I came to France. Now I'm 10,000 more times opposed to it. Mm-hmm. He believed that the only way a democracy could make big decisions was by the decisions of electors, by the voters. And so he realized that the only way you could, in a democracy, make a decision about slavery is that the people had to, by vote, decide to end slavery. He knew that was a huge problem, that you had to educate the public. You had to sort of change people's minds. And he wasn't sure. He thought maybe, he knew his generation was too racist to do it. He put great hope in the coming generation, young men, he said, who had sort of imbibed liberty, as it were, with their mother's milk. So he is hoping his generation, he believes, cannot do it. He has huge hope the new generation, the coming generation, will be able to do that. And so he puts all his hopes on the future. Now, I have to say, he does not foresee, when he's thinking about this, the cotton gin and sort of the spread of cotton and the spread of slavery across the South and race attitudes hardened and so forth. So he sort of makes a bet that the next generation will be able to do, will sort of live up to the highest ideals of the nation. It doesn't. I mean, slavery is going to be more firmly attached in the nation in 1830 than it was in 1780.
Yeah.
He just makes a misbet. And there are very complicated personal reasons, which by law he's not allowed to free a slave. So it's kind of this problem. Here's a person who is a legitimate opponent to slavery, yet simultaneously is a lifetime slave owner. It's a tragedy. It's a tragedy to him. It's a tragedy to the nation. He understands that. He sees no way out of this dilemma. And so if we want to be sort of, I think, true to Jefferson and true to the past and true to history, we need to not sort of judge him as a person who is a failure because he didn't do what we would do, we think, but we need to sort of understand the complexity of his time and the kind of dilemma he saw and the contradictions within his, he has this contradiction between his belief that slavery is wrong and his belief that you can only end it through electoral decision.
Mm-hmm.
And that there's, of course, a conflict. He doesn't see any way out of it. I wished he could have. I wished he could have done differently.
Sure.
But, you know, he didn't.
Yeah, yeah. Avoiding the Civil War, one of several reasons why that would have been.
I mean, you think about it. I mean, Jefferson just couldn't have sort of by fiat ended. I mean, yeah. Washington didn't. Marshall didn't. And, in fact, it took a Civil War and, you know, maybe 750,000 deaths to change the situation.
Indeed. I'm curious, John, where are you from?
Actually, I was born in Houston during World War II, but I grew up on a small farm in East Texas. So I grew up as a farming kid.
The reason I ask, and it's obvious listening to you that you come from parts southward, I found, and I could spend a half hour talking on this subject alone, but you talk about a lot of history that is specific to the American South, and you've done a lot of studies of the American South. And people may not just automatically, when we're talking about Jefferson, think of him as Southern, but he was a proud Virginian. And how was his life and his views, how were they shaded as the result of being a Southerner?
Well, you know, we think of the South today as sort of a subsection that, I mean, in Jefferson's time, the South was not seen as kind of a backward or racist area. I mean, the South, I mean, this is the time when the South is, in some sense, at the foreground of progressive politics. I mean, Washington and Jefferson and so forth, they're nation builders.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the nation in 1800 didn't see itself so divided. It talked about, I mean, the sense of the idea of a really distinct South doesn't really emerge until after 1818 or 1820 or so.
I see.
Jefferson saw himself as a Virginian, but he saw himself very much as a nationalist. He believed, though, that the Constitution said that the national government basically had all the power in terms of international commerce and things like that, and that more local things were the matter of the states. I mean, he didn't say that the states were more important than the national government, but that each had their sphere of influence. And he could understand that as needs changed, the Constitution should be broadened and sort of let the sort of national powers grow as the nation needed. But he believes that he even uses astronomical comparisons, how the planets are balanced by gravity and so forth, that the nation is this balance of powers, not only between the three branches of government, but between the powers of the states and the power of the national government. And that's, in some sense, the genius of the Constitution, how it holds this together. But we should not imagine that the Constitution, as it lays out the precise powers, should be fixed in time forever. You know, he says that a lot. And he also says that a president has a real obligation to obey the laws, but that's not the only obligation, and that sometimes a leader of a nation has to be willing to make a decision that is, in some sense, beyond the powers of the Constitution in situations of incredible opportunity or incredible danger. And that then, after a president does that, the president then has to be willing to go back to the American people and then to ask for forgiveness or ask, you know, he says, for example, the Louisiana Purchase. There's a case when, at the moment it happens, of course, he doesn't realize they're going to be able to buy this. And his first reaction is, we've got to pass a constitutional amendment. And then his word begins to come in that Napoleon is having second thoughts and so forth. And if you begin to dilly-dally and start talking about that Napoleon may void the whole agreement. And then he realizes, if we begin to talk about constitutional niceties here, we may lose a third of the nation. And so we just need to do it. And then, again, that's one of those occasions in which a president, in huge situations of importance or opportunity or possibly danger, has to make a bold decision beyond his actual stated powers and then come back to the nation to ask for forgiveness or ask for retroactive legal authority. So, I mean, he's not sort of muscle-bound, in a sense, by the Constitution. He has huge belief that the Constitution lays out the fundamental law of the nation, but that you could not let a nation die or miss an amazing opportunity because of a rigid adherence to law. Mm-hmm. You have to, but again, you know, sometimes you don't have time to ask for permission. It's like you do it, and then you ask for forgiveness.
Yes. Yes.
But you have to be willing to go back to the nation, if necessary, to explain your position and then sort of take the consequences.
John Bowles, our guest again. He'll be on campus next week. The Kinder Institute sponsoring the annual or twice annual Town and Gown Dinner Lecture with the Kinder Institute for Constitutional Democracy. That's democracy.missouri.edu. And I've got one final question for you here, and obviously you're a person that has spent much of his life on a campus, like myself, and as Jefferson, the scholar, a man with a lot of interest in a lot of different areas, as we've already discussed, sort of an example of the value of the classic liberal arts education. There is a thought, and it's not universally held. I don't want to insult anybody by saying that all people on the right believe this, but there are some now that have sort of moved away from the respect we once kind of universally held for education and the educated. And talk a little bit about that and why that's concerning from the standpoint of a Jeffersonian, someone who studied Jefferson.
Well, from the most crass viewpoint, I mean, all the evidence shows that people with a college education make more money in life, if that's how you measure things. But, I mean, if I think the measure of life is not how much money you make, but it's kind of the fullness of your life and the ability of your life to sort of enjoy and to learn and to evolve and to create. And I think there's no doubt that the kind of exposure to the huge range of ideas and disciplines and so forth that a person gets in a good college education allows a person to live more fully, to live more creatively, to live more imaginatively. And I don't, in my own mind, think students, you know, that you get a degree in history or philosophy or engineering just because it helps you sort of make money, but it opens all kinds of opportunities. Jefferson was an example of a person who he saw his interest was unlimited, and I think that's what an undergraduate liberal arts major allows. You take courses in history and English and philosophy and science and mathematics, and it reveals worlds that you never imagined. And I just think that's what college is. It's kind of an opening up to people. I mean, I grew up in a small town of uneducated parents, and I had a very narrow view of life and possibility. And when I came to college, I just had presented to me through the library and the teachings and the professors and the writing and so forth, I just had a whole world of opportunity opened up to me. And, every day I feel grateful for the fact that at one time in my life I read philosophy and literature and history and science and so forth, and it changed how I think about life and living.
And now as a professor you get to open those doors for others, and that's a marvelous way to dedicate one's life.
Yeah, I think what a privilege it is to be able to teach.
John Bowles, again, he will be here at the University of Missouri campus next Tuesday, April 10th, for the Town and Gown Dinner Lecture. Kinder Institute for Constitutional Democracy, their website is democracy.missouri.edu. And Professor Bowles, thank you very much for your time. Safe travels, and we'll look forward to welcoming you to Columbia.
Thank you very much. Look forward to it. Thank you.